And I'm joined now in the studio by Malcolm Guy. Malcolm Guy and I and Coco Wright and Frida Guttmann, we're all on a panel on art and activism. And I'm just going to introduce you to Malcolm Guy. Malcolm Guy is a director and producer of documentary and fiction films, president and co-founder of Productions Multimonde. Malcolm is active in immigrant rights organizations and in the independent film community. He contributed to establishing the international film festival Rencontre Internationale du Documentaire de Montréal, the Observatoire du Documentaire, the distribution company Les Films de Trois Mois, and is active in DOC, the Documentary Organization of Canada. Malcolm's films look at a variety of local and international issues, with a particular interest in the Philippines. He's a founding member of the Center for Philippine Concerns in Montreal. Welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, Vince.
I just wanted to start by asking you a few general questions about your work. How did you become a documentary filmmaker? Actually, you aren't just a documentary filmmaker. You also work on fiction films, like feature films, I guess.
Yeah, I try to do a variety of films. My own films, as such, tend to be more of the documentary variety. That's what I enjoy doing. I enjoy being with people. That's the most fun part of it, is actually the going out there and listening to people's stories and trying to put them together and in a form that can make a difference and do justice to what they've told me. So how did I get started? It was, I guess, a long, kind of complicated path, but I'll simplify it here. I was involved during I was involved during the 70s and kind of the revolutionary movement in Quebec at that time. And during the 80s, that didn't work out quite as we'd planned. So I was kind of searching around. I worked for a while at the CBC on the radio, on the morning show, Daybreak, and Radio Noon and stuff. And then I thought, this is nice and I'm enjoying this, but I really don't really have the chance to tell the stories that I want to tell as fully and as completely as I want. Mm-hmm. So my partner and I, Marie Boti, decided around 1987, to found a film company. But it wasn't so much that, it was to start making films. And I'd got my start with a friend who took me to the Philippines, which is where my interest in the Philippines particularly comes from. So just before we decided to set up our film company, a couple of years before, it was a big movement in the Philippines to overthrow the dictator there. So my friend Steven said, I need somebody to do the sound. Can you come along and help? So I learned what doing sound was on an independent production. Essentially, you carry everything that the other person can't carry, and you get involved right in the struggle. So we went to the Philippines a few times. I learned about the struggle there. I'd already known about it, but I got even more deeply involved. And I got kind of picked my curiosity. I said, here's a form that, kind of agrees with what I am and who I am, combining sound, because I'd done radio before that, pictures and real people's lives and stories. So that was it. So thanks to Steve, who invited me along to the Philippines that time, I, along with Marie, decided to start doing documentaries in the mid-80s.
Well, the thing I noticed with the list of films that you've got here is that, one of the main sources for your funding would be the television networks. There's an enormous amount of networks that have supported you over the, like, who have broadcast your work, basically.
Yeah, I consider that part of my political work.
I mean, I'm sort of astonished because you're talking about fairly revolutionary thinking. I'm amazed that you can get this work onto mainstream media. Like, how does that happen?
How does that work? Lots of hard work. Essentially, I guess it's kind of the combination between activism and, filmmaking or art as such. I'll give you the example of a film I'm working on now. So it's going to be on Radio Canada, on the French network, coast to coast. And essentially, I work at the Immigrant Workers Center in the Côte d'Image area. And it's been a big source of inspiration for some of the projects we've done. And we started to notice coming in the door at the Immigrant Worker Center were these workers who were here in Canada, in Quebec, in Montreal, as contract workers. Not just farm workers. We'd heard about the farm workers, and before that we'd done quite a few films about the nannies, you know, mostly right. from the Philippines. But here they were coming, and they were working in fast food, they were working in as gardens, they were working, anyway, in various areas as laundry people. And I said, ah, something's going on here. So anyway, through the work, we helped these people through the work of the Immigrant Worker Center, and we started to look at what is this phenomenon. And we discovered that actually, starting in about 2008, more people are arriving in Canada today as contract workers than are arriving as immigrants. Ah. We said, ah, there's an interesting subject for a film. So it took a while to convince Radio Canada because they hadn't heard about this. It wasn't in the headlines yet. It was kind of in the, you know, thanks to our relationship with the Immigrant Workers Center, we kind of had a front line, you know, a front row seat on what was going on. So that was it. So this film, which is going to be coming out this year, and it's tentatively entitled The End of Immigration, question mark, is going to do that. So that's kind of, yeah, the combination that I've seen between my activism and my filmmaking as such.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, that's news to us too here, the listeners on CKUT, I'm sure, probably not heard about this very much so far. How do you see your work tying into, you know, the global struggle, basically? What do you think informing the public will do for, you know, the movements for progressive change in the world?
I think filmmaking is part of that. I've always said that, you know, the artist's place is in the struggle. I'm not the first one to say that, but that's always been my maxim, you know. And I've always thought about who does art serve, particularly which class, which people, the 99% or the 1%. And so those have been, that's been a factor. And I've always seen, you know, being an immigrant who came from, with my parents from England, and we immigrated here, the question of kind of the global and connections between Canada and our neighborhoods and everything else and the rest of the world has always been a part of me and who I am, and my partner Marie as well. She's also from a family of immigrants. So those interconnections kind of led me to have a global look at what was going on, and to try to combine the local and the global in everything that I do. So in the same way that I'll be working on the Immigrant Workers Center here, I also work in a global anti-imperialist organization called the International League of People's Struggles, which is in about over 40 countries and has about 350 organizations. So I do those small and local, and I also try to do the global. And for me, it just makes sense. I can't see the world any other way. And I hope that the films that we do in some way will look at that as well. So we always try to have a global outlook in our films, even if we're treating a local subject. In the sense, this idea of all of these migrant workers here, you know, for me, it's important to know where they come from and why they left where they are in order to come here as migrants. So those interconnections are always part of that. So films, I think, are really good in that they can reveal things and, you know, uncover things, perhaps like this film that we're doing now about the changes in immigration in Canada. But I think it's really, they're a reflection of people's struggles, and it's kind of dialectic, right? We do the films after stuff happens, at least documentary films. But I think most art, in a way, anyway, I'd argue that most, if not all, art is a result of that. It's kind of people give us the inspiration. We condense it and put it into a form that's perhaps agreeable and more condensed and more people are able to, imbibe in a short period of time, to push the struggle forward even more. So I see that as kind of the dialectical role. But the first thing for me was not piece of art, the film or whatever. That was kind of a reflection, and it helps to push it on and perhaps give it a shove forward. Is that the way you see your involvement as well, Vince?
No, because I work. I've come from a more of a solitary background, really, like as a poet. So, you know, I started just, you know, trying to find that zone of what is a poet? Where does poetry work? Like working on the actual nuts and bolts of the craft. And then at a certain point, you know, you start to, well, my relationship to campus radio probably is the source of most of my politicization, I would say, because I started doing campus radio in like 1985. And, you know, I've been a volunteer for many, many years here. And then before that at other stations in Canada. It's always been like a really strong part of my psyche. And you can't help but soak up the, you know, you hear Chomsky on the radio for the first time and, you know, you're suddenly your horizons are wider, right? You know, kudos to CKRT for airing that back in like whenever I first heard it, 87, 88. So that begins to enter into your process as an artist. That's what I find is that, you know, I'm writing poetry and I might be writing about, you know, something on the table in front of me, or I might be writing about what I think about some political situation. It's always going through this, subjective filter, because I think that that way the listeners or the people who hear your poetry or read your poetry, or your prose for that matter, will identify in that sense with the way that you're relating to it rather than just sort of, you know, quote, objectively feeding them, you know, an idea or whatever about politics. So, you know, one of the major poems I did in the last few years was about oil. And, I'd been struggling with how to tackle a topic that huge from a subjective perspective because, you know, you look out the door in the morning and it's like there's cars everywhere. And suddenly you have that moment of sort of realizing that, you know, the implications of that, this sort of hits you. How do you transmit that or retransmit that to the readers or the listeners? And it also helps to think about the audience because for that particular poem, I had to come up with a poem for an anarchist poetry reading. And so I was like, well, I want to really hit them with something like topical. And so I revisited the oil thing, which I'd been trying to get a poem written about for years and managed to nail it finally. And part of the reason why I could nail it is because I took on board the responsibility, like the individual responsibility, like everyone is tied into the oil industry. It's just like, you know, back in the Bronze Age, bronze was like ubiquitous because it was completely transforming culture. Oil has done that now. And you know, to pretend that you can be a saint and that you don't burn oil is completely impossible, right? You know, you just have to put food in your mouth and you're burning oil somewhere because some truck brought that food to you. So I wanted to get that point across because that way the people who otherwise might feel guilty and just sort of turn off will say, well, I'm there too. You know, mm-hmm. I'm also worried about this, but I'm also like tied into this system and how do we deal with that? So it's it's an interesting thing to deal with on an artistic level for sure. Like, do you have a sort of a concept of the system you're up against and how, what sort of changes need to be done?
Like, yeah, I do. I guess I am, you know, I consider myself, you know, I think we need to change the system fundamentally. So I'm a socialist. I support all struggles in that sense. I support all struggles for progressive social change. But I think if we reverse the society and put the 99% in control, that would be the best way to do it, right? And so I really see a fundamental revolutionary change that has to take place within our societies. There have been attempts. They haven't been successful yet. But we can learn from them, and we shouldn't put them aside or throw them aside. There are many valuable lessons to learn from what happened in Eastern Europe, Russia, many other places. And for me, I really feel that that's what provides my impetus to do what I do. And I guess, yeah, because creating is, it's tough, you know? It's really tough to get up in the morning and say, I'm going to create today. It's one thing. Yeah, it's nice to get paid occasionally for it, but often you don't, right?
Yeah.
Especially when you're doing progressive or revolutionary works like that. So you do need that drive, you know? You really need to feel that in some ways you're helping to make a difference, even if it's a tiny little way. And also it makes you feel better, right? You feel good about that because you do get kind of positive feedback. Mm-hmm. And people react well to that. They react well to what you're trying to do, and they kind of catch on to it. You know, some people don't. Some people don't like it, but that's okay. Yeah. Usually, I don't like them either, so we're fair. You know, and I think it's I really like that idea of making people think and making them reflect and making them look at the world differently. And I hope you know, other people will join me in a drive for, you know, turning over and upsetting totally the system in which we live, not rounding off a few corners, but totally rebuilding it. And you know, I think it takes a new kind of person, a new kind of artist, a new kind of society in order to reflect the needs that we have, you know, be they our over reliance on oil or our proclivity to invade and kill other people in the name of you know, saving them.
Commerce. Well, yeah, it's such a huge, you know, it's a tall order. We're just going to overturn the system. The problem is that, of course, the people who are, you know, the elites, the 1%, they have all the levers of power, or, well, they have a lot of levers of power. So a lot of people become discouraged and kind of compliant to the system because what else can you do? Like, you have to eat and so on and so forth. I'm just wondering, like, what signs of hope do you see? What sort of optimistic things are happening in the world in the last, say, year or two that we can talk about a bit that might be pointing towards change?
Wow. Last year, of course, there was all events in North Africa and the Middle East, right? I mean, who would have thought, you know, that in Egypt, of all places, that the people would rise up there and try? Who would have thought in Bahrain and Qatar and all of these other sheikdoms that the people actually didn't like what was going on there? And despite the total blackout of media coverage of the alternative movements and the fact that they throw most of them in jail or get rid of them or kill them if necessary, that this would happen. So the people, I mean, that was pretty amazing way to start off last year. So, and I found that virtually every year you can find a few things that kind of set you back on your heels, you know. Not long before that, it was the attack against Gaza, which started off the year, and that was an incredibly negative way. But at the same time, the people of Gaza didn't give up. They fought back, and probably out of their suffering came an even greater understanding of the role of Israel as kind of this imperialist outpost in you know, in the Middle East. So I think someone's cutting the grass outside our studio here.
They're salting the ice.
Okay. So anyway, so all that to say that last year it was a very positive year. Of course, there were setbacks. You know, the warmongering now against Iran and all of this stuff, it's quite worrying. But, you know, at the same time, wow, last year was incredibly. And then, of course, we finished the year with the Occupy movement. Who would have thunk again, you know? Here in the belly of the beast, you know, people would actually get up and start to organize. So, yeah, lots of stuff happening. I'm really encouraged for this particular year.
The thing that strikes me about the Arab Spring is the, like, underlying the what we see happening, the revolutions or the rebellions, is the fact of intense suffering on the part of the people there that we are kind of oblivious to in the Western world because we're so doped up with consumer goods and dope and various other distractions. Can you talk, because you have some experience, you know, with third world conditions, or I don't even know if we can call it third world anymore, but, you know, parts of the world that are more oppressed, of what these people are up against. And because it makes me respect them even more to know, like, how crushed down they are by the elites in some of these countries.
Yeah, what amazed me, I guess, one example is I filmed in this place in the Philippines. It's called Smoky Mountain. It's essentially the garbage dump of Manila, which is a city of about 12 to 14 million people. So you can imagine it's a pretty healthy garbage dump. They've actually closed it down because they got a lot of criticisms, but they moved it elsewhere, and it's just as big and just the same. But at that time, we were on Smoky Mountain. Why it's called Smoky is because it's such a huge mountain of garbage that there's spontaneous combustion in the middle of it. So when you're walking across it, it smokes and it's quite warm. You know, the right. bottom of your running shoes get kind of all melty. And so people live on there and they collect the garbage. But same way with the new garbage dump in Manila, these are organized communities. Yes, they've been forced off their own land, off their own place where they were living into this huge city. They found a way to survive. But at the same time, many of them are organized into groups and organizations which are fighting to better their situation and also to try to look at building a society where this won't have to happen. So even there, in the middle of this garbage, people were organizing. For me, that was incredible. I said, how could it be? Here, I would just sit here. I would sit here crying all day, you know, feeling sorry for myself. But no, these people were organizing and, well, they were surviving. It was incredible. This was the most efficient recycling system I had ever seen, you know. They recycled everything from bits of plastic to bits of wire to, it was incredible, the ingenuity of the people, right? But at the same time, they weren't just sitting around. They were attempting to organize and better their thing and say, we don't want to spend the rest of our lives here necessarily, and we don't want other people, our kids or our grandkids, to have to face the same thing, so we'll organize and we'll do it. So they survived each day, and then they met in the evenings and on the weekends and every spare time they had to start to organize. So that's an example that if we look beyond the kind of the first level, I think that's the role of artists as well, is to look beyond the first level and uncover what's really in there, the real heart, the real essence of what's there. And I tell you, you know, the thing that's missing on the films when we were filming there, because it's very photogenic, a garbage heap that smokes, right? And there's all people all over. It's like amazingly photogenic. And I said, the thing that's missing is the scratch pad so you can smell it.
Yeah.
I said, that's what we need to provide with our, because otherwise it looks quite amazing. And poverty is very attractive, as we've seen from other films that have come out, you know, Slumdog Millionaire and so on. It's quite an attractive thing. And now there are people going there to visit and so on. But I mean, if you go past that first image, which is, I think, the role of an artist, and go to the essence of something, even there you can see hope.
Can you tell me like some artists that inspire you, the artists that have look at the situation of the world and make that extra step?
Oh wow, there's so many. I'll just mention one right now. He's an artist in the Philippines. He's a political prisoner. He was arrested for his beliefs by the Philippine government. He's a young artist, songwriter, poet, and so on. He's stuck in jail, totally trumped up charges put there. His crime is having attempted to change the society and dared to put forward alternative ideas in the face of the Philippine government's, you know, kowtowing to the United States and other powers. But he hasn't stopped. He hasn't stopped writing. He hasn't stopped inspiring people, doing his poetry. I mean, there are many political prisoners who have done that. But here's an example of one who inspires me each time. I go on his Facebook group, and God, he's more productive than me. You know, I guess it helps to have a little bit of time on your hands like that. But he hasn't stopped. Yeah. And I guess that's one example of someone who I admire. Of course, there are many examples in history like that. There are people who have given their lives for their beliefs and because of their artistic work, you know. And I guess, you know, in his case, you know, he really took kind of Bertolt Brecht's quote to heart, you know, Erickson Acosta, because he, you know, he said that, you know, Bertolt Brecht, although there's some controversy as to whether it was just him that said it or came up with it first, but he said, art is not a mirror held up to society, but a hammer with which to shape it. And Erickson Acosta in the Philippines really believed that, and he's paying a high cost for that, you know.
Right,
he hasn't stopped. And that, the fact that he's doing that in jail, is an amazing inspiration for hundreds of other artists there. And it just has a whole impact, you know, internationally, but even on the local artistic scene there, people look up to him.
So he's in jail for his ideas.
Yes, essentially, yes. But what they do is they come up, they usually trump up some civil charges, incur, you know, either charge them with murder or something like
that.
Or embezzlement or something like this, so that it's not a political charge.
Right. It's sort of, that's sort of discouraging, because, you know, there's watchdogs like with the UN and so on who are supposed to be looking out for political prisoners. And so, of course, the powers that be just come up with some way to trump up charges instead.
Yeah.
It's very, very annoying. I just wanted to mention, in terms of inspiring art, I just went to a show of Native artists at Art Mirror, which is up on St. Hubert Street.
Yes.
And there's some quite amazingly strong work there. There's a piece by Rebecca Belmore. There's Edgar Heap of Birds has an amazing piece. And Tanya Willard had a piece that particularly moved me, and I recommend that to anyone who's interested in progressive work.
Take that in. Yeah. I think the what's happening in the Indigenous movement, both in Canada and you know, the First Peoples movement here and globally, is quite incredible at the moment. They're really on the front lines of the resistance to Canadian mining companies, among other things, but also on the front lines of the resistance against global warming and all of the, you know, affronts to the planet that are happening right now. So I think it's great. We see our Prime Minister today meeting with Native leaders. You know, he's going to try and buy them off and integrate them into the system. But from what I'm hearing, they're not going to have any of that.
I think they're no longer a sleeping giant.
Exactly.